Most nights and weekends we do German.
Okay.
Nice to see you.
Spoke to the guy in our house because we didn't have share a language.
You know, they didn't get out, so I had extra time with them.
When were they supposed to leave?
They couldn't get money.
Okay. So I think we'll get started.
He has a sister. My guy has a sister.
Because he's from Iran.
Oh, you have your
name.
Sorry.
No problem. I'm as interested in this as anybody. Okay, so where we left off last time, many moons ago, was discussing the that is true. I hope everybody had a wonderful and meaningful Chanukah. Unfortunately, about last time, last semester. Yes. Right. Last semester we actually did several court classes on Chanukah. If I had thought far enough ahead, I would have flipped everything around. I would have done this semester last year and the Chanukah stuff this year. But be that as it may, everything is on, or almost everything. I think two of the classes are not on YU Torah, but almost everything else is on YU Torah. Where we left off last time was discussing the history and the historical context of what we might call, for lack of a better word, sectarianism within late Second Temple Jewish society. So we discussed the Essenes, whom we delineated as distinct from the Dead Sea Scroll sectarians, whomever they might be. And the reason why, so just a brief note before we move on to another installment in that series, the reason why this is important is because it's all a build-up to next week. Next week is when we're going to discuss yet another, and again, sect may not be the right word, but we're going to discuss another group within this complex common Judaism of the first century BCE, first century CE, and that is the movement that coalesced first in the Galilee and eventually in Judea around Jesus of Nazareth, and we're going to discuss that next week as yet another Jewish group. That was jostling for influence within this melting pot, if you will, of Jewish authority. And then we're going to discuss either the week after that, or if the powers that be require us to adjourn for the holidays. And when we come back, my plan is to continue discussing the rise of Christianity and the rise of Rabbinic Judaism, archaeology, and the rise of the ancient synagogue. It's a really fascinating, fascinating period. So we'll discuss starts out as a Jewish group engaged in intra-Jewish squabbles transforms into something that is substantially and, in fact, definitionally different than that. So this week, what I'd like to do is set up our discussion of next week by exploring briefly, the history of a group that we might set in direct opposition to the eventual followers of Jesus, and that would be groups that people in the popular parlance broadly refer to, and as we'll see, incorrectly refer to, as the Zealots. The Zealots of the late Second Temple period. Why do I say late Second Temple? Because they are literally the last thing that they do is fight in defense, as they see it, of their freedom and of the integrity of the temple. And they die defending that temple and eventually the other outposts where their troops are stationed, and that is the end of the Zealots. Now, when we talk about Zealots, we are truly discussing or truly amalgamating several different groups that Josephus talks about. The Zealots are one of them. Some of you may have heard, I think I've mentioned it once or twice, some of you may have, the source sheets are two pages. Unfortunately, I couldn't squeeze everything until one. The Zealots, some of you may have heard, because I've mentioned the book before, there's a book by, what's his name? He's an Iranian fellow. He's a talking head on many of the talk shows. It's called Zealot. It's about Jesus. The name is escaping me at the moment. Reza Aslan. Reza Aslan it's a New York Times bestseller. The argument of the book substantially is that Jesus should be included in the Zealot grouping, which is of course absurd because the Zealots don't arise, according to Josephus, if you read him carefully, don't arise until at least the year 66 of the Common Era as the revolt is beginning. This is a group that forms at that point. But there are other groups who have anti-Roman, broadly speaking, tendencies, whom Josephus does discuss before then. They are the followers, and we'll explain what this means in a moment, the followers of Judas the Galilean, Yehuda HaGlili, and then, more importantly for us this evening, the Sicarii, which is a group that we're going to have to describe. But broadly speaking, it means, if I had to translate the term, the assassins. This is a Jewish group that is operative. Well, we'll get to their origins. The setting. So that's sort of the dramatis personae. The setting for our investigation this evening is going to be the desert fortress of Masada. Some of you may be familiar with the poetry of Yitzhak Lamdan, who wrote an entire epic poem about Masada. The reason why you may be familiar with it is because one line from the poem has become particularly famous, because it has been, or it was at least until recently, incorporated into an IDF ceremony. The IDF graduation ceremony was staged at Masada until relatively recently. And part of the ceremony, if I'm not mistaken, was the incorporation of a line from this poem celebrating what it understood as the fall of the heroic freedom fighters, Jewish freedom fighters at Masada. And the line is, "Shenit Masada lo tipol," Masada shall not fall again. The ethos that underlies this sentiment is substantially one that has been promoted, perhaps for good reason, as we'll see, that has been promoted by, basically, by the Zionist movement. The story of Masada, although it appears in one medieval source, which is Yosifon, which is sort of a medieval, this is a complicated topic in and of itself, but broadly speaking, it's a medieval Jewish historical work. But the only contemporaneous source that we have for the events that transpired at Masada is Josephus. Josephus is the only source that we have for anything that ever happened at Masada. So our knowledge of what happened there is entirely dependent on really two things. Josephus and archaeology. Right. So what we're going to do this evening is explore perhaps several questions. Number one, is the popular understanding of Masada, which is, as I said, broadly that there are these freedom fighters who are warring against Rome and in so doing warring against tyranny, who made their valiant last stand and tragically valiant last stand at Masada, where they eventually killed themselves rather than submit to the chains that the Romans wished to impose upon them, or are we dealing with something somewhat different from that? As we're going to see, our evidence needs to derive first and foremost from close readings of the text, the one text that actually describes these events, and that is Josephus. But more important to me is what happened at Masada. Why is number one, what happened at Masada? Number two, why are the events of Masada important within the larger context of Josephus's narration of the war against Rome, which is, of course, important not just to Josephus, but, of course, tremendously important to Chazal and to all of the Jewish people. This is what we commemorate every single year on Tisha B'Av. The events of which Masada was apparently an integral part. Josephus devotes about over 50% of the seventh book of his Judean War, which is there. It's 7 out of 7. So there are 7 books in his narration of the war. He devotes over 50% of the seventh book to narrating the events of Masada and sort of subsequent events. So it is quite important within the context of Josephus, and I'd like to explore what makes it important, why it's important, and then, of course, of primary interest to us and of overriding interest to us is why does this matter to us? How can this inform our Jewish practice and our Jewish conduct in the current day? So we're going to have to ask ourselves two questions. Number one, after outlining very briefly the narrative that Josephus gives us about the events of Masada, we're going to have to ask ourselves the following question. If we are looking purely at the archaeological remains from the site, can we comment at all on the accuracy with which Josephus reports those events? If we can't, in other words, if the entire thing is a fabrication, then there is perhaps nothing to talk about. Perhaps not, but there's perhaps nothing to talk about. If we can verify some of it, then that's something else entirely. And if we can verify all of it, then of course that would be wonderful. After we examine what it is that we can know about the events of Masada from the archaeological remains, we're going to examine what Josephus tells us about Masada and why he tells us it. Okay. So beginning at the beginning, archaeology. So Josephus tells us several things about the story of Masada. Josephus tells us, basically, just to broadly outline the events, a group of Jewish, what would be the best term for them? Patriots might be one term, although, again, there were no doubt patriotic Jews who opposed them. Perhaps the best idea would be an anti-Roman rebellious group of Jews called the Sicarii. We're going to have to explore their genesis and their development in just a moment. But a group called the Sicarii, who became famous for their high-profile assassinations, of whom we're going to explore in just a moment. But they became famous for these assassinations. They were violently opposed to Roman domination of Judea, and expressed this by getting involved in a broader rebellious movement against Rome. What ends up happening is that, in fact, the first Roman blood that is spilled on the field of battle is by the Sicarii when they take over the fortress of Masada. Josephus says, via trickery. They somehow trick their way into this desert fastness, and when they enter it, they gain access to a host, says Josephus, of food that King Herod had stored there nearly 100 years before, how it was still fresh, Josephus tells us about. They gain access to weapons, and so on and so forth. Lots of things happen in between. We're going to explore those in a moment, until eventually the fortress is besieged by a Roman legion and its auxiliary units, which is about 13,000 men, and the fortress falls rather quickly. That is another misconception about Masada. It's not some sort of glorious, extended pitched battle between the Romans and Jews. It was a fairly standard Roman engagement that was over pretty quickly. And we're going to explore why, for Josephus, that would have been, and for us, that is actually extremely theologically relevant. Now, what is Josephus, what part of Josephus' narrative can we either confirm or deny via archaeologists? Take a look at source number one under the heading archaeology. Josephus tells us about two things that the Sicarii rebels found when they took over Masada. So the top source in source number one, all these foodstuffs stored by Herod, Elazar ben Yair, is the titular head of the Sicarii who have taken over Masada. There are other Sicarii leaders. We'll mention them in just a bit. But Elazar is the leader of the garrison, of the Sicarii garrison that's based at Masada. So he says, when they came to Masada through treachery, master of the fortress, they found in perfect condition and no whit inferior to goods recently laid in a whole host of foodstuffs. Now, what we would expect to find, if this were true at Masada, were various containers that perhaps we might be able to date from the Herodian period of stored goods, of goods that were perhaps dried goods, pressed goods, things that could survive for a long time, especially in the sort of high altitude arid climate that is Masada. So Masada, in fact, archaeologists have worked on Masada. The final reports were published in 1995. Have confirmed that, in fact, you could store food for an exceptionally long time at Masada with minimal insect damage and the like. So take a look at the two pictures that I've given you of pottery remains that have been found at Masada, and see if we can decode these together. So look at the top left one. That's a shard of pottery, and I want someone to tell me what it says. I'll give you a hint. There's a letter. There are four letters there. The one on the right is a little bit grayed out, but I'll give you a hint. It's a Dalid. So could anyone tell me what that says? First letter is a Dalid. So what's the next letter? So the one all the way on the right. It's a little bit faded out. There are four letters. The first one is a Dalid. The second one is a Bet. The third one, you're correct, is a Lamed. And the last one, it looks like a Chet, but this is how in the Judean script of this time they would have written a Hey. So what does this spell? Devela. So for those of you who remember the Gemara in Elam Etzios, one of the things that the Mishnayos talk about there, and when it's discussing things that should and can or must not be returned to people, one of them is igule devela, right? Cakes of pressed figs, right? Devela are pressed figs. These are things that store exceptionally well in arid climates and would have been left over from the and on other grounds we can determine would have been left over from the Herodian period. So here we have an example of something that Josephus tells us that we can more or less confirm. Take a look at the thing, the picture just to the right of that. Can anyone decipher that? So the first word you're correct. The first word you're correct is devela. The next word is a little bit less clear, ketusha, and the third word is yafa. Dvela, ketusha, yafa. Well pressed fig cakes. In other words, another item that stores very, very well. Cakes made of these dvela. In other words, fig cakes. They store very well. So here is perhaps a minor point, but a point where we can confirm something that Josephus has told us with some certainty. The next one is even more certain. Look at the next piece of text. At this time, a certain Menachem, son of Judas, took his acquaintances and withdrew to Masada. There, after he broke open the armory of King Herod and fully armed the different bandits, as well as the commoners, he returned to Jerusalem. So this is one of the major, as we'll see later on, one of the major rebel leaders of the Jewish forces, who we can see from this text was undoubtedly allied and was himself probably a Sicarii, is a fellow named Menachem, the son of Judas. His father's name will become important in a couple of minutes. Menachem, this text tells us, was fighting in Jerusalem. He was part of the rebellion in Jerusalem. And then, because he wanted to resupply with weapons, he went back to Masada, where, as we know, who had taken over Masada from the Romans at this time? The Sicarii, and his cousin, Elazar ben Yair. Elazar ben Yair was also a descendant of this Judas, who we'll talk about in a moment. So he goes back to where his cousins and his fellow Sicarii are holding out. He breaks into King Herod's armory, which they hadn't found a use for yet. He breaks in, he takes out all the weapons, and then he comes back. Then he comes back to Yerushalayim and rearmed and ready to do battle. So now, what would we expect to find at Masada if this were to be true? We would expect to find, first of all, weapons, but what kind of weapons? Weapons that on some grounds we might be able to date positively to the reign of Herod. Now, this might seem difficult. In other words, if we found a rifle there, we could know positively that it didn't date from the first century BCE. We could say with some certainty that that would be true. But we found a sword, so unless it was made of stone, if it was probably made of bronze or perhaps had some inferior iron in it, so then people had been using bronze and iron weapons forever. How could we possibly find a weapon that could be dated positively to Herod's reign? Take a look at the picture to your right, now that I've set you up for this. This is called a gladius hispensiensis. This is called it's a certain type of sword. It is double-edged. It's perfect for, first of all, slashing, and second of all, stabbing, which was very important. This is a weapon that, by the time of the Jewish revolt, would have been relatively short. What is remarkable about this blade, which was found at Masada, in one of the places where the rebels we know were holed up, is that it is extremely long. It's 610 millimeters long. Swords of this sort were not made at that length, other than for a very short time during the reign of Herod. So we know that this is a weapon that could have been that must date to the period of Herod, and therefore it seems to confirm something that Josephus told us, which is that the rebels, when they broke into Masada, armed themselves from the armory of Herod. So now we're going to, in the interest of time, we're going to skip to source number three, Lots. I'll give you just to quickly sum up what we would have seen in source number two. Source number two, we would have seen that the catapult stones, the ballistae, that the Romans, that Josephus tells us that the Romans launched against the Jewish fighters on Masada, is found we found cannonballs not only all over Masada, but in particular, directly opposite where the siege ramp was. So we know that the casemate wall, which is the main wall where the rebels would have been defending themselves, as Josephus tells us, it's been found to be destroyed. So we know that the Romans broke in precisely where and how Josephus tells us. Source number three is perhaps the most interesting for us. Source number three is as follows. How did the people of... So someone tell me, what happened at to the defenders of Masada? How did they die? Did they die? Mass suicide. So now, they committed suicide. In other words, they didn't want to fall into the hands of the Romans. So how did they decide how to die? They all hanged themselves? Right, they drew lots. Right, and so in short term, I'm saying they killed their children. Right, they killed their children and their wives. So how did they decide how it worked? So as Mr. Deegan says, there are lots. They drew lots. Now, what Josephus tells us is that first, They had to draw lots from among all the men, which Josephus tells us there were 960 people on Masada, 960 fighters. So several hundred lots would have had to have been pulled. And once they decided by lottery who would be the 10 men who would slaughter everybody else, then they had a subsequent lottery amongst those 10 to decide which one would kill which other one. And so finally there was only one person left, and his job was to kill himself as well. Right, 960 people, including women and children. So there would have been, let's say, several hundred fighters. You know, maybe 500, 300, you know, 300 to 500 fighters.
Josephus hit himself, correct?
So Josephus is not at Masada. That's an important thing to recall in just a moment. Josephus never went to Masada. Josephus was involved in a similar story where he was involved with people at a place called Yodafat, where he was also holed up and everybody wanted to kill themselves, so he managed to extricate himself from that situation, and that was how he joined up with the Roman forces and eventually wrote his history of them. Josephus was thought by some early historians, mostly because they were Zionists and saw in sort of the rebellion against Rome precursors of the Jewish state. We're going to examine that claim in just a moment. They saw Josephus as an unsavory traitor. So how do we know what happened? So Josephus claims that I believe it's six or seven people, women and children, who managed to hide themselves in a cistern. They overheard what was going on, and then they sort of came out and told Josephus everything that happened. That's what Josephus... And then Josephus claims elsewhere in his autobiography that the reason that he has such accurate military information, which he does, is because he read the commentarii, which are the Roman military reports by sort of Roman commanders in the field. Now, so one of the things that was found at Masada upon its excavation in the 60s was 10... ostraca, which are pieces of pottery. Back in this time, paper was an extremely difficult substance to acquire. And if you wanted to have a writing surface, what you wrote on were pieces of broken pottery. You couldn't put them back together again. One of the reasons why pottery is why pottery can't be kosher. You couldn't put it back together again, so what did you use pottery for? Broken pottery? You used it to write on. So they found 10 shards of pottery, all of which came from the same jar, and upon which names of 10 men were written, all of which were written in the same hand, by the same person. Of added significance, and the text that I've given you here, is the text where Josephus describes the lottery of 10 people. So several lots were found. The number is actually important. I'll tell you the number in a minute, how many lots were found. But one of the lots was the one that I've given you on the right there. Can anybody decipher that name for me? It's a little bit difficult. But let's at least take the first two letters. So that looks like a shim, but it's actually two letters. The first one is a bet and a nun, so ben. Now, what's the letter after that? It's a yud. Ben Yair. Elazar ben Yair, recall, was the commander of the Sicarii at Masada and was one of the ten men who was responsible, who became part of the lottery. So, upon discovery of these ostraca with these names on it, there was great excitement because these were thought to be the very lottery shards by which the macabre lottery at Masada was carried out. It's possible. Part of this this becomes problematic when you consider two things. Number one, there were 10 pieces discovered, there were 11 pieces discovered with names on them. Whereas if there was a lottery of 10 people, you would expect 10. And then, as Ira points out, there was actually a lottery before the one amongst the 10 men. They had to decide who amongst the several hundred people was going to kill everybody. So you would expect if we were going to find lots on Masada, that how many would we find? 300, 500. So it seems, although it is very tempting to identify these as the lots as the lots of the story, and thereby to confirm Josephus's account, it seems a little bit difficult to do that. This is also, and the second concern is that no bodies, there's no mass grave that was ever found at Masada. There were 25 skeletons thereabout or pieces from 25 skeletons that were found, but where they were found were also found pig bones. So it's likely that these were not Jewish bodies that were buried there. So archaeologists who doubt the veracity of Josephus' account think instead that the fighters on Masada, however many they may have been and whoever they were actually captured and didn't commit suicide. Were actually captured. So it could be, yes.
Was that after 1960s? Was that another excavation?
Right. So the excavations at Masada are actually ongoing. The people who are working on them are famous archaeologists by the names of Jody Magnus, Ehud Netzer, and Guy Stiebel, I think his name is. Anyway, these are the archaeologists working on them, and they're continuing to publish reports. So, this is as far as really as archaeology can take us, which is to say that we have, I think, quite good evidence for the military component of Josephus' account, which is that I think we can confirm that there were rebels who broke into Masada and somehow managed to get access to things that Herod would have stored there, both food and weapons. I think we can also say with some certainty that the assault on Masada took place precisely as Josephus described it, namely there was a siege tower, he says, on the northwest quadrant. They fired catapults and ballistae at the defenders so that they couldn't stop the Romans from constructing a siege ramp. Once they constructed the siege ramp, they burned through the stone wall and then battered through the stone wall and burned through the wooden wall that the zealots had erected, came inside, and then what happens next is where Josephus' report becomes somewhat more cloudy. As we're going to read much of what Josephus says and analyze it, but we should say that at least from the perspective of archaeology, although it's tempting to try and verify Josephus' account by pointing to these lots, it seems to me that there are really nothing of the sort. So in terms of figuring out whether there were actually fighters on top of Masada who committed suicide via lottery, it seems to me substantially less clear. It doesn't seem impossible. It's not impossible, but we can't verify it one way or another. So the question that really...
really
yes.
Long time to process
of killing, right, 960 people.
So while they were doing all of that, the Romans are battering down the wall.
Ah, excellent question. Couldn't have set it up better myself. What were the Romans doing while this was going on? What were they doing? So keep this question in mind. It's going to become absolutely crucial as we conclude our analysis. What were the Romans doing while all of this was going on? So the question that I'd like to ask, therefore, is not is Josephus' account verifiable or true? But I think the more profitable question would be to ask, once we can establish, broadly speaking, that Josephus is telling us about events that, in their broad factual pattern, occurred, what is the purpose that Josephus is aiming at in giving us a narrative like this? In giving us a stirring, sometimes infuriating, as we'll see, a narrative that really does evoke such strong emotions in the reader. Whether it be, as we'll see, admiration on the part of Romans, perhaps admiration on the part of Jews, admiration on the part of 20th century Zionists, revulsion by sort of revisionist historians. What is it that Josephus is trying to communicate to us by giving us a powerful narrative like this? So, the way I'd like to explore this question is by asking the following. How does Josephus deploy the characters that are the protagonists of his Masada narrative throughout his narrative of the war? In other words, of the revolt against Rome. In other words, who are the protagonists of the Masada narrative? The Sicarii, right? Those Jewish rebels who stood atop Masada and defended themselves, and eventually, in his narrative, killed themselves. Who are the Sicarii? What does Josephus have to tell us about them? What is their role prior to Masada? And therefore, what can we say about their function in Josephus' mind at Masada? And then, of course, what can we learn from this? Now, if you look under the literary theological heading that I've given you here, what does Josephus tell us? We're going to have to start by asking the following question. Josephus is giving us a narrative of the revolt against Rome. Now, let me ask you a question. Chazal have an extended narrative of the revolt against Rome as well. According to Chazal, what are the causes of the revolt against Rome? Proximate or immediate, proximate, and I suppose more abstract. So what's the famous one that everybody learns in grade school? Why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed? Sinas Chinam. Oh, Kamsa Bar Kamsa, right. Sinas Chinam. Right, in other words, it was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. Okay. So that's sort of broad cause number one. In other words, now, Sinas Chinam, is Sinas Chinam a geopolitical force? No, what is it? It's a theological force. In other words, who cares about Sinas Chinam? Vespasian? Titus? Who cares?
The rabbis.
The rabbis, more importantly, who has the ability to do something about it? Hashem. Right, so God cares about, so there's a theological cause. And then, another thing, another cause, is the fact that Chazal understand that the, in the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, that the sacrifice on behalf of the emperor was cancelled via a whole mistake that Chazal seek to explain. Josephus has a similar narrative, although in Josephus it's not a mistake. So in other words, there is an actual rebellion against Rome. People are fighting for freedom, whatever it is they think they're fighting for. But there's also a theological cause. So now let's turn to Josephus' account. So that's Chazal. So let's turn to Josephus' account of what exactly went wrong during the period of the revolt. So he says in source number one, I shall faithfully recount, this is the very beginning of his book called The War, which is his narrative of the revolt. I shall faithfully recount the actions of both combatants, the Jews and the Romans, but in my reflections on the events, I cannot conceal my private sentiments, nor refuse to give my personal sympathies scope to bewail my country's misfortunes. So in other words, he's going to tell you now exactly what he thinks, not as an historian, but as an editorialist, what went wrong during the revolt. For that it owed its ruin to civil strife, in Greek, stasis, right? Infighting amongst Jews, similar to Sinas Chinam, but here he means it in a political sense. And that it was the Jewish tyrants, the Turanoi, who drew down upon the Holy Temple the unwilling hands of the Romans, and so on and so forth. So in other words, the problem for Josephus is what? People don't like Rome, that's true, but what does Josephus think is more corrosive even than trying to fight against a powerful empire? Right, fighting amongst yourselves. Fighting amongst yourselves. So stasis is the key word here. Now these two words, stasis and Turanoi, keep them in mind, they're going to become important later on. So stasis is the reason for the revolt, infighting amongst Jews. Now, who is the instigator of this infighting amongst Jews? That brings us, source number two, to the Sicarii. How did the Sicarii come to be? In other words, there is a time, let's say 300 years before this, when the Sicarii don't exist. By the time of the revolt, everybody knows that the Sicarii exist. So where do they start? The answer is they start sometime in the 50s of the first century C. The revolt starts in 66, and about the 50s, is when they get their start. And Josephus tells us in source number two, when the country was cleared, in other words, there had been all sorts of unrest in the country, people were murdering each other, when the procurator, the Roman governor of Judea at that time, whose name was Felix, had put everything to bed, a different type of bandit sprang up in Jerusalem, the so-called Sicarii, murdering people in the middle of the city in broad daylight. Now pay attention to exactly how he describes them. Especially during the festivals, they would mix with the crowd, hiding small daggers in their garments, and they would stab their opponents. And so Jonathan, this is Yonasan ben Chananya, one of the who was formerly the Kohen Gadol a couple of years earlier. So Jonathan, the high priest, was the first to be slain by them. But after him, many were done away with each day. The fear was worse than the misfortunes, because hour by hour, each person expected to die just as in battle. So, Sicarii, how are they? First of all, it's clear, at least to me, that Sicarii does not equal rebel. In other words, there are rebels, there are people who don't like Rome, but what makes the Sicarii, this group, what makes this group distinct from other rebel groups?
They're killing
each other. Right. One thing is, just conceptually, they're killing Jews, right? They're not killing Romans. Who is their victim here? In fact, their only victims, their only named victims ever are always Jews. The Sicarii are always murdering Jews.
What's the theological basis of the Sicarii?
Oh, excellent question, right? Excellent. So why are they doing what they're doing? So we're going to explore that in, I think, two sources. Let's put a hold on that for now, because it dovetails with Malvina's question somewhat. So let's put a pin in that for now, but let's keep in mind, why are they doing what they're doing? Why are they killing people? Why are they killing anybody? But B, why are they killing Jews, and why are they opposing Rome? What do they hope to gain from this? So in a conceptual sense, they're distinct because they're killing Jews, not Romans. But what makes them distinct in a practical sense?
They killed the high priest, so
it's even worse, right? In other words, they murder the Kohen Gadol. Now, that has halachic implications, the murder of the Kohen Gadol. If you murder the Kohen Gadol b'shogeg, you don't have the benefit of the Ur Mikla. So you or rather in other words, you don't ever go free rather from the Ur Mikla. But what makes them distinct? Are they just killing anybody? Or they're killing people by shooting them? They're killing people by throwing slings at them? How do they get their names? Sicarii. The daggers, right? Their daggers in Latin are called sica, right? They're distinct because they stab people with these daggers and in stealthily. In other words, they go up to people in broad daylight and they stab them, and then Josephus describes how they try to hide themselves. So they're assassins, right? Sicarii are assassins. That's how they distinguish themselves. Okay. Now, look at source number 3.
Who
were the opponents of the Sicarii? So the narrative, almost not immediately after this, but shortly after this, tells us about the first major fighting that broke out, that kicked off the revolt, which is in about, 64 to 66 CE. What happened was that there was a fight that broke out between the rebel elements and those Jews who were supportive of Rome, which included the Kohen Gadol, some prominent Pharisees, and those who were simply loyal to Rome, and some Roman soldiers. There was a fight in the upper city of Yerushalayim, and in particular over the temple and over the palace that was in the upper city, and these forces are fighting it out, duking it out, until finally the Sicarii come riding in and turn the tide by helping them kill all the Jews that were defending the palace, and they eventually take over the temple and press the siege against the palace. So the Sicarii are
the Jewish supporters of Rome.
Are the Jewish supporters of Rome. And we'll develop that more in a second.
It sounds like the flip of the Hanukkah story.
It's almost right. So in other words,
they were Roman Hellenists. They were killing what they considered the Roman Hellenists.
Right. In other words, that's an important point. There are eerie, almost dystopian parallels with the Hanukkah story. Right. In other words, in the Hanukkah story, how does the Hanukkah story start? We last semester we saw this in First Maccabees. But we know this. People generally know the story. Matisyahu, how does Matisyahu get his start? Right, what happens? There's a Jew who's a prominent Jewish nobleman who volunteers to bow down to an idol at the behest of one of the Syrian Hellenistic rulers. Matisyahu is so enraged by this that he kills him on the spot. So in other words, the Hanukkah story kicks off with intra-Jewish violence, and we're given to understand by our tradition, by the first book of Maccabees, that it was justified because the entire Jewish faith was at stake here. So here, we almost have a dystopian parallel to the Hanukkah story, because here, here there actually is legitimate disagreement, really legitimate disagreement, over how to deal with Roman occupiers and Roman overlords. In other words, what should our stance be towards a very powerful nation that is seeking to rule over us at a time when we have a temple and we have some sort of control over our lives? Should we revolt against them? Should we submit to them? What should our stance be? So, if you look at source number 3, helps Josephus develop the point of why he tells us about the Sicarii in the first place. We mentioned earlier that one of the leaders of the Sicarii forces with whom the Sicarii at Masada associate is this fellow Menachem, the son of Judas. So now we're going to explore his career at a little bit greater length. So look in source number 3. At this time, a certain Menachem, son of Judas. Now, Josephus is going to tell us who his father, or perhaps grandfather, was. Who is this Judas? Judas is the one called the Galilean, right? He's from the Galil. And what did he do? Josephus actually has a whole long passage about this Judas. Josephus tells us he's a very powerful teacher who is one of the first people to start preaching anti-Roman messages, and he gains a lot of people to his standard. So Josephus summarizes for us here something that he's told us at greater length elsewhere. He's the one called the Galilean, a most formidable sophist who had berated the Judeans back in the time of Quirinius. Quirinius was one of the governors of Syria. Why? Why did he berate the Jewish people? Because they were subjecting themselves to the Romans after God. In other words, they didn't want to be free. They wanted to be servants of the Romans instead of being servants to God. The way the Prussian would have said is that it's not that we're servants instead of God, we're servants to the Romans politically, in addition to our overall servitude, our overarching and all-encompassing servitude to God. That's what perhaps Chazal would have said. But the way that this Yehuda HaGlili saw it, Judas the Galilean saw it, was that the ideal was to be free from all tyrannical overlords. So this is who Menachem's father is. Now, what does Josephus tell us? That this Menachem took his acquaintances and withdrew to Masada, right? So he went back to his Sicarii allies on Masada. And there, after he broke into the army of King Herod and armed all of his soldiers with fresh weapons, he returned to Jerusalem quite like a king. Basileus is the Greek word for king, which means like a royal ruler. And after becoming commander of the civil strife, the stasis, after he really takes command of the stasis going on in the city, he began organizing the siege of the loyalists in the palace of the upper city. Now, eventually, he's successful. He captures the palace. He kills the Kohen Gadol. And then he becomes so powerful that Josephus says he felt as follows. Both the reduction of the secure places and the death of the high, really the murder of the high priest Hanania, deluded Menachem to the point of savagery. Thinking that he had no rival in affairs, he was an unbearable tyrant, a tyrannoi. Now there are two words here that have appeared earlier in a passage that we saw from Josephus. What are those two words? Stasis and tyrannoi, right? Now, how did Josephus use those words earlier? Why did Josephus use those words earlier? To tell us what? Right, the causes, is that right? The cause of the Jewish war, the cause of all the misfortunes that befell our people during this period, were because of people who were promoting stasis, who were promoting infighting, sinas chinam, if you will, and people who were acting as tyrants, who were sort of drawing power to themselves so that they could lord it over everybody else. In other words, they weren't just fighting Rome because they thought it was the right thing to do. They were fighting Rome because it was popular to do it, and it could help you control your fellow Jews and your fellow people and amass, as we're going to see in a moment, great wealth and so on and so forth. So now, what is Josephus doing here? Josephus is a master. People only, ironically, scholars only recently have realized what a masterful writer Josephus is. Right. So the point of the Sicarii in Josephus' narratives, as Mrs. Deegan, is that they are actually the fulcrum of this entire problem. In other words, they are the focal point of all the madness that is afflicting the Jews of this period. And more importantly, why is this ironic? Who was Menachem's father? Judas. Now, Judas was anti-Roman also. But why, and this gets back to Dr. Schwartzbaum's question, why was Judas anti-Roman? What was his motivation?
I guess what was going on in the temple.
Right.
It would have seemed that maybe they would be worshiping the emperor.
Right, so that...
Or bring sacrifices to the emperor, or...
Right, so what does that tell us? In other words, you're correct. Josephus tells us that they canceled the sacrifice in honor of the emperor, but what is that symptomatic of? What did they feel was wrong with doing that? How is it apostasy? Why is it blasphemous to offer sacrifices on behalf of the emperor or to serve the emperor? Yeah, exactly. Because by serving the emperor, you are neglecting to serve Kadosh Baruch Hu. So Judas's ethos is that we must revolt against Rome because we have to throw off the yoke of slavery and tyranny. And his son, who takes up his banner, although Judas was not himself a Sicarii, they arise only much, much later, 50 years later, Menachem, his son, and the Sicarii themselves, what do they end up becoming? What's the word that Josephus uses to describe him? Tyrannoi and Basileus, right? Kings and tyrants. The very thing that the anti-Roman rebels sought to achieve, which was freedom, they ended up subverting themselves by very virtue of their complete lawlessness and rabid anti-Romanism.
Exactly the story of Hanukkah, where the Maccabees start out
as
slaves, and then they become the king.
Exactly.
And the high priest.
Exactly. Right. So it's this, as we said before, there are these very, and that's why I think this is very relevant to the Chag that just passed. There are dystopian echoes of the story of Hanukkah, where we can see now, all of the things that we celebrate on Hanukkah that went right here are almost taken to their darkly logical conclusion and are going terribly wrong. Now, Josephus, before we move on to our conclusion...
He was writing for the Romans, though, wasn't he?
The question is, for whom was Josephus writing? Josephus is actually writing for two people. He's writing for his not first and foremost, he's writing for his patrons, who are the Flavian emperors. The emperors who conquered, who put down the revolt, Vespasian, his son Titus, eventually Domitian. So he's writing for his imperial patrons in Rome. And he's writing for Gentile audiences, but he's also writing for Hellenistic Jewish audiences, for people who wouldn't have been, Jews who would not have been familiar with the events, and who wanted to learn about them. So Josephus, and this is something that we could spend an entire, we could really do an entire class for a year on readings in Josephus, and we could see how Josephus is very often writing with incredibly clever ambiguity, such that a text would purposefully mean one thing to a Roman audience and a completely different thing to a Jewish audience. And he's doing this, I believe, on purpose.
You think he can be trusted?
Yeah, that's what
Josephus? So what I tried to establish earlier is that there are certain things where Josephus's information seems pretty unassailable. There are other instances where Josephus may have been either embellishing, perhaps fabricating. Fabricating seems to me to be a little much, because there would have been people who would have called him out on it. But he seems to at least be embellishing, perhaps making many parts of his narrative up. But what we have to ask ourselves is not sort of in a post-Enlightenment sense, is what Josephus said true and factually accurate for its own sake, but what is Josephus trying to tell us? He's a masterful writer. He's not making major mistakes because he's a dunce. Josephus is writing with a very specific purpose in mind, and we have to try and divine what it is. If at the end we decide that it's something to which we object for halakhic reasons or ashkafic reasons, that's one thing. But what we're trying to figure out here is what is the role that the Sakarii play in Josephus' writings, and then what does that tell us about how we should read the story of Masada? So take a look at the next source number 4. Yes.
Why?
So this is actually a hotly debated question. For those who are interested, there's an article that was published in 2005 that discussed this at length. Basically, the reason that we say that is because Josephus tells us several things about who captured Masada. What is common to all of them is that in every instance, in other words, Josephus tells us the Sakarii took over Masada, and then he never once after that says that anyone else ever held the fortress. And it's clear that at the time, that any time that someone goes to Masada after it is taken over by the Sakarii, there are people there. Now, who would they have been if they weren't Sakarii? We have no idea. So it seems abundantly clear from Josephus that the Sakarii held the fortress and maintained it, and there were other people who were coming and going at different times. There are sources that say this explicitly. Unfortunately, we didn't have time to include them. But there are sources that tell us this explicitly. There were actually other rebel groups that would come and visit and would be sort of included eventually amongst the Sakarii. One thing that we've seen. We'll actually save this point for the next source. Take a look at source number 4. Source number 4 is one of the main pieces of information that Josephus gives us about the Sakarii right before the Masada narrative, and that is this. He tells us, the so-called Sakarii had captured Masada, but up to this time, they did nothing more than make raids in the surrounding areas to get supplies. Why? Because they were afraid. They held back from wide-scale robbery. But when they learned that the Roman army wasn't moving, they set upon greater crimes. And during the Feast of Pesach, when the Jews celebrate the saving deeds at that time, when they put aside slavery to the Egyptians, at night, they slipped by those in the way, and they overran a small town called En Gedi. They scattered and drove out of town those who were able to defend it before they could grab their weapons and gather together, but they killed those less able to flee, over 700 women and children. Then, after plundering the homes and gathering the ripest of the crops, they took them back to Masada. The Sakarii, who are sort of in the 1960s imagination, these glorious freedom fighters on behalf of Jewish liberty against the Romans. So far, who have they killed?
Women.
A Kohen Gadol.
Women
and children. Jewish women and children. These are the Sakarii who are defending Masada. So at this point, at least at this point in the narrative, this is going to change. But at this point in the narrative, are we dealing with heroes or villains? From our perspective. We're dealing with villains. Now, the problem is, at this point, as Josephus is aware, at this point, their villainy is almost cartoonish. It's almost unrealistic. Meaning, these people are so depraved, they're just going around slaughtering Jews under the pretense of opposing the Romans. It can't be taken seriously. But, before we move on to complicate this picture a little bit, there are two points that I would like to elaborate, and then we'll hopefully close. That is, first of all, again, to reiterate a point that we made before, the Sicarii, ostensibly, are fighting for freedom. All right, they're fighting for freedom from tyranny. Right? Why? Because we want to be free to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, when do they, or Josephus emphasizes this, when do they attack the Jews of En Gedi? Pesach. What do we celebrate on Pesach? Freedom! Freedom. And the genesis of Am Yisrael as a nation, our ability collectively, together, through creative, dynamic cooperation to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And on this very Pesach, they go out and kill 700 Jewish women and children. Flooring. Number two, and this is a technical point, at this point, the Sicarii seem to have become not the Sicarii that we know, the stabbing, you know, the assassins. Presumably when they killed the people of En Gedi, they weren't using sort of one-by-one assassinations. They were operating as a regular rebel gang. So at this point, it becomes clear that for Josephus, the Sicarii are now...
It could be that the Romans, you know, made it up, that they went there and did it. People like me today in battle. Nobody else did it. It wasn't us, you know.
Right. Well, so actually, in the interest of answering that question, let's quickly turn to source number five, so that we can get to the end there, because I think it actually is quite relevant. Source number five, Josephus tells us the following. And this, by the way, this gets us back to the question that was asked earlier. Who asked earlier, what were the Romans doing during all of this? Right. So Malvina's question, what were the Romans doing during all of this? This actually becomes crucial. So at this point, because at this point, where are we? Josephus has told us the broad cause of the war is stasis, right? Infighting and tyranny. Who represents better than anybody the infighting and the tyranny of which Josephus speaks? The Sicarii, right? The Sicarii are the ones who are... They're killing lots of Jews, so there's infighting. They're grabbing lots of power for themselves. That's Menachem, completely contravening the teachings of their ancestor, Judas the Galilean, who preached freedom from Rome and freedom to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This becomes such a chronic epidemic amongst the Sicarii that they eventually embark on this savage raid against their fellow Jews. And this is crucial. For Josephus, there are two ways that he could have narrated... It's clear that they needed to come to a grisly end. There are two ways Josephus could have narrated this. Either he could have, in deference to his Roman patrons, set up a narrative whereby the Romans sort of come in and methodically, characteristically, professionally, come and destroy them and take them captive and parade them around and so on and so forth. In fact, many people thought that that's precisely what Josephus did, because he's a very clever writer. But take a look here at this passage, which I think is very crucial. Take a look at source number five. What Josephus tells us is that as the Romans were about to breach the fortress, so they battered down the wall, and then they set fire to the secondary wall, and with the intent to burn it down. The rebels at this point, the Sicarii, are completely helpless. But the problem is that there is a wind that is blowing against the fire, and it's threatening, Josephus tells us, to blow the fire all the way back onto the Roman siege engines and destroying everything that the Romans had built. And then, suddenly, says Josephus, changing direction, just as by divine providence, a south wind blew full force in the opposite direction against the wall, and now it was burning through and through into the Sicarii ranks. The Romans, thus blessed by God's aid, returned rejoicing to their camp with the determination of attacking the enemy on the morrow. Tactically, this seems almost unbelievable. It may have actually happened. This is an argument. It seems almost unbelievable. In other words, the Romans are on the cusp of victory. By some magical happenstance, the fire has reversed itself and burned through the wall, and now they can kind of just waltz in and kill everybody. Instead, what do? They leave. They walk down the ramp, presumably, and retire to their camps and wait for tomorrow. Now, in order to make sense of this, we need to understand what the motif is. What is the theme of this paragraph right here? Why does all of this happen? Does all of this happen? Divine providence. Hashkacha. Hashkacha pratis is what's going on here. So although Josephus has spent, which we haven't seen, pages and pages and pages and pages telling us about Roman ingenuity and military professionalism and their incredible martial prowess, what is it that eventually turns the tide of victory in favor of the Romans, and more importantly, against the Sicarii? Right. The Almighty. Exactly. It's the Almighty who does this. Why? for answer, and with this we'll conclude, the most famous part of the Masada narrative are the two speeches that Elazar ben Yair, the commander of the Zealots, gives right before they commit suicide. He gives two speeches to convince everybody to go along with his plan to commit suicide. Now, bear in mind, if we had more time, we would go into this. There is a strong tradition. We've already seen this in a previous class. In Judaism, there is a strong noble death martyrdom tradition in Judaism. We've explored it. It becomes muted, although not entirely, in Chazal. And there are echoes of the Chazal position in the earlier writings as well. But there is a strong belief in the option or in the existence of a noble death, dying well, and even of martyrdom. And in the Roman tradition, especially with the legacy of Socrates in the Greco-Roman tradition, there's also a strong tradition of believing that if God gives you a reason to be killed, or if God makes it clear that you deserve, or your fate, your destiny is to be killed, then taking it upon yourself to accept that, and perhaps even to kill yourself, would have been considered incredibly laudatory from a Roman perspective as well. So there are two audiences that would have read this with different precedents in mind as being laudable. So how does Elazar convince his compatriots to go out in flames like this? So Elazar tells us, number one, source number six, and we have 30 seconds to do this, maybe indeed we ought from the very first, when having chosen to assert our liberty, we ought, I say, to have read God's purpose and to have recognized that the Jewish race, once beloved of him, had been doomed to perdition. What is he saying here? He's saying something that Josephus has told us all along. Wish we had more time to explore this, but that from the very beginning, it was folly to rebel against Rome. Why? Because as Chazal tell us, right, as Yirmiyahu told us when we rebelled against the Babylonians, as Chazal tell us when we rebel against Rome, this is not a rebellion that was destined to succeed. It was not a Kadosh Baruch Hu's will that we rebel at this time in this fashion. So Elazar here has accepted in Josephus's, and these are the words that Josephus is putting in the mouths of people that he absolutely abhors. He's putting in his mouth tshuva. In other words, they recognize we've made a mistake. And then finally, what does he tell us? Do not attach the blame to yourselves, nor the credit to the Romans. This is what Elazar is telling to his followers, that this war with them has been to the ruin of us all. It was not their might that brought these things to pass, but the intervention of some more powerful cause that has afforded them the semblance of victory. What is he saying here? It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who brings this about. This humanizes, in a sense, people who, as we've seen so far, have so far been nothing but monstrous. Here Elazar is recognizing two things. One, we've misjudged this entire enterprise. This wasn't the time to rebel. And B, that it was God orchestrating this all along. And in truth, if you read Josephus' narrative, it was not really the Romans who won a great victory here. It was the Romans who were the beneficiaries of God's punishment of the Sicarii. And so it's almost a chiastic structure. The Sicarii promote infighting amongst the Jewish people. They and in order to stave off tyranny and slavery, they themselves become tyrants until finally their infighting causes them to self-destruct and to become the victims of infighting until, at the very end, God punishes them for doing those very things. It's a beautiful chiastic structure. The last 10 seconds, Josephus clearly views the Sicarii as less than heroes. So the view that sees them as these sort of unambiguous superheroes is likely a distorted picture of what Josephus offers us. However, Josephus makes it clear that his villains are not cartoons. They're human people with motivations, with real motivations, and maybe laudable motivations. Freedom is certainly a laudable motivation. But undirected, inattentive to powerful, true Jewish leadership, they get out of hand and become self-destructive. We as a community are positioned in such a way that we can well relate to this. It's common to lament the deterioration of rabbinic leadership in our ranks, let's say in modern Orthodoxy writ large. We look to the Rabbi Soloveitchiks of old, and we pine away for those for a figure like that. We lament the deterioration of leadership. And yet, at the same time, or perhaps not yet, what this gives rise to, I think, is a temptation to demonize all the small-minded people who are preventing the rise of great leadership like this. There are demons to our right, clowns to the left of us, jokers to the right. And here we are, and we imagine ourselves stuck in the middle. In other words, we are the chosen few who understand the right thing to do. What I think we can take away from the Masada narrative is not, like I said, cartoonish vision, Manichaean vision of good and evil, where we have well-defined heroes and well-defined villains, and it's easy to tell the difference. I think what we can take away from this narrative, which is, despite all that we've said, as powerful as ever, is an appreciation for the fact that while we are perhaps going through a difficult time as a community, trying to define ourselves and searching for leadership, searching for a model of life that is serious and that takes our belief in the transcendent seriously, that works, it is crucial that when we see people with whom we disagree with and when we interact with those to our right or to our left, with whom we have very serious differences, that we resist the temptation to demonize them to the point where we reach the sort of infighting that destroyed our people at the end of the era of Bayesheni, whether it be Sinas Chinam in the parlance of Chazal or Stasis in the parlance of Josephus. And with that, we will conclude and pick things up next time. Yashar Koach to everybody.